Hey, Jill Nadeau here. I'm filling in for Larry Mueller. Glad to have you with us today on the Ideas Network. Phil Pelletieri is back to talk about spring insects and answer your insect questions. Phil is an entomologist and a distinguished faculty associate emeritus. Phil retired as head of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab in 2014, and he stops by to talk about insects every other month. We're going to look at bees, wasps, and some insects that you don't want to see in the next few weeks. Do you have a question about an insect that's been seen in your yard? What have you always wanted to know about bees and wasps? Join the conversation. Give us a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. You can post on the Larry Mueller Facebook page. Great to see you, Phil.
Nice to be here.
And it's so nice outside. I imagine that the bugs are going a little crazy.
Yeah, my grandson and I have had some great adventures the last week going out collect things. And so
how fun. So are you training him to fill your footsteps?
No, he's showing an interest. And right now it's in collecting anything that moves. And so that keeps it fun.
That's awesome. Now, we were talking about bees and wasps. And I know everybody, except for the experts, kind of gets them mixed up. They call a wasp a bee and a wasp. What can we do to distinguish between the two?
Well, probably if you look at a bee, generally most of the species, and we have over 400 species of native bees in Wisconsin, they're fuzzy. And what if you look under the microscope, their hairs are like a feather. They're branched.
Okay.
Generally speaking, wasps might have a few single dark hairs on their body, but they really aren't. Now, behavior-wise, bees basically take pollen and nectar, and that's all they're interested in. They're never interested in people food. Wasps are more scavengers, although they will take nectar from flowers. Many of them can eat meat and ripe fruit and those kind of things. And those are the ones that get us in the problem in the end of summer when people call them garbage bees, but bees have no interest, again, in a garbage. You can make the argument that wasps are beneficial because they also eat pest insects,
right?
You know, especially caterpillars and the like. So I said they have kind of a mixed blessing. And one of the interesting things we see at this time of the year are what we call spring bees, but they're active often for only a couple weeks. They're collecting pollen. Most of them nest in the ground. Some of them are even stingless. And again, because they go in the ground, people confuse them with these fall ground nesting wasps that can really be a problem. But these spring critters are really not a problem at all.
And where do hornets kind of get in there?
Well, hornet is entomologically not a all-inclusive term. A critter can be a wasp and a yellow jacket and a hornet, and it's all the same beast.
Oh, okay.
So hornets are basically going to be a type of wasp, but they're kind of a subgroup, and there's really no good definition.
Okay.
You know, some things are called hornets and their first cousins aren't, and that makes no sense, but that's the way it is.
Okay. Well, that's helpful. So we have to keep an eye out for those fuzzy things or the good bees. Are the bees out right now?
Yes. I've seen bumblebees. I haven't seen any of the solitary ground nesters yet, but it's time. I mean, typically, once I see crocus come up, I can expect to see some of those. And if you've had an area in a flower bed where they've been active, it's going to be an annual occurrence. But as I said, 2 or 3 weeks down the road, they'll just disappear and you won't see them again until next spring.
Oh, really? So where do they go?
The females at this time of the year will dig a hole, provide it with pollen, lay its egg, and they're done. So it's really not a nest. I mean, when you think of a nest, you think of a queen and workers and
something
goes on. And so the grub develops, larvae develops on its own, and then will transform in the fall, stay in the ground during the winter, and then come out next spring. So it's a single generation. And generally, what we would define as a solitary wasp or bee are non-aggressive because there's no nest to defend. When you get bumblebees and yellow jackets and honeybees that do have a queen and a true nest, that's when they're most aggressive, is when the nest is threatened, and then they will do what they can to stop whatever outlier is coming in to bother them.
Defend their home, right? Okay, well, you wanted to talk a little bit about some kind of nasty bugs that we may be seeing in the next three
weeks.
Well,
not nasty, but my experience is people overlook these until it's too late to do much about them.
Oh, okay.
And honestly, both of these critters are not damaging to our plants, but they're a cosmetic problem. So the tent caterpillars that will be active, and I would guess that within the next week, the tents will start to be active on your trees. And they overwinter as eggs on the tree, and as they just start to hatch, you know, it's about the size of a quarter. You could go out there and crush it with your hand. You do something very easily, but people are just not paying any attention.
Sure.
What will happen is you go 3 weeks down the road, you know, the larvae are already an inch and a half long. They're done feeding. They're crawling off the tree, and then they want to do something. And it really is past the point of making much effect. Another critter with a similar kind of activity is the sawflies that we see on our mugo pines and some of our imported pines. It's a little green worm. It eats all the old needles off. That's when it catches your attention. But you're already done seeing the damage. But I can assure people, if you look very carefully in the next week or so, you'll see little tiny worms. And one thing about sawflies, they always work in groups, in clusters.
Okay.
Now, both these insects are capable of stripping most of the needles or leaves off the tree. But when that happens in the spring, the plants recover.
Okay.
So that's why we say it's cosmetic.
Okay.
And so we really don't get that concerned about them being seriously damaging insects. But what they do is so visual that catches people's attention. And that's why I think people get so upset about it.
It does. I mean, it looks scary with all those worms crawling all over. So,
right.
All right. Well, let's go to the phones because they are full right now. Let's go to Kay in Madison first. Hi, Kay. Do you have a question for us?
Yes. I have a question about drain flies. I think that might be what I have. Little tiny black critters that they kind of hop around. And
yes.
I usually find them near my cat's wet food or sometimes near the sink. And I wondered, and that's right by a dishwasher. So I'm wondering what they are and what they look like, if that's what I've got, and what do I do to get rid of them?
Sure.
Thank you.
Your observation of them jumping, that's very characteristic. They're a true fly, but their wings are covered with very fine hairs. And so they're also called moth flies. It's the same beast. And one of the classics, if you crush one, you often get powder, much like if you crushed a small moth. And the larvae are associated with caking organic matter that's wet. And so the name drain fly usually refers to something like a basement drain or maybe an overflow cut in a bathroom sink that gets a lot of organic matter accumulating. It always stays moist, but it really never flushes clean. Now, I don't think the dishwasher, unless you've got some problem. If you had a clogged drain, I think that would show itself. But what you get, this caking of goop in these drains, and that's where the maggots develop, and then the flies come out into your living space. What usually works the best is get a really hot pail of water and flush it down the drain. Or even cleaning the drains at times will help. Bleach doesn't get you anywhere. A lot of people think that if they put bleach down there, it kills the critters, and all it does is sterilize the surface of the organic matter, and the drain fly larvae can live behind it. For an overflow cut in a bathroom, again, whatever you can do to clean it out. But usually if you can clean, flush, they're gone. And so I would kind of hunt the source of the problem. And if I had to start, it's a basement floor drain, because most of our floor drains don't get enough water to really flush totally clean. And as I said, my first avenue is to get a real hot pail of water, try that. If that doesn't work, then you can get some of these bacterial digesters that you put in the drain that will help eat through that goop. And I think the bacteria ones are probably more effective than the caustic ones, you know, that people use. But it can be quite a bother. Once you solve the riddle, though, you should be done with it.
All right. Well, good luck, Kay. Hopefully get rid of those. Let's go to Jean in Sun Prairie. Hi, Jean. What's your question?
Hi, Phil. When we had some early spring weather, perhaps it's a January thaw, I'm sure that a doormat in our garage had a lot of moisture from snowmelt, and it was crawling with little black bugs the size of mouse droppings.
Oh, okay. Did they hop at all?
No.
Okay.
They crawled, and we were bringing home stuff to take to St. Vinny's, and I saw one on top of a bag of clothing. I'm like, uh-oh. So I got rid of the mat, happened to have some ant and roach spray, which we haven't had roaches since New Orleans. But I sprayed around because there's a wooden step that they could be hiding under, too.
Okay. Because of the time of the year, there isn't a whole lot of things that can be active, but where I was trying to go with this is, there's some critters that are sometimes referred to as snow fleas, and they're not fleas at all. What they are spring tails, and many of them that come out in February and March are very dark bodied, you know, black. And they feed on organic matter and they need moisture. And so they can be found in the soil and the like. Once things dry up, they're gone. You know, they're really not a problem, but sometimes you get these eruptions. And again, that's when happened. People are out skiing in March and they look on the snow and it's covered with this black stuff that some species jump, some don't. And all it is springtails that have come to the surface and been active. And I could see where they'd love to accumulate under a damp mat. That's just a nice place to be. But as I said, usually what we would try to do is dry things up and that should solve the problem.
Okay, well, thanks for the call, Gene. Let's go to Mike in Lake Mills. Hi, Mike. What do you have for us?
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
You bet. What do you have?
Well, I'm very interested in bumblebees, and I've read that you can make little houses for them. And I was wondering if your guest had an opinion on how effective those are, what time of year you best put them out, and then if you are successful, do you have to leave them there? Does the queen overwinter in them, or
sure.
What?
Now is the time. And basically, the queen, what you're seeing now flying around are the queen bumblebees that have spent the winter, and they are typically looking for an old rodent burrow or some kind of cavity, and on occasion, they will also utilize birdhouses if the birds haven't moved in. And she'll get in there and start raising her young, and that colony will continue to grow, and depending on the species of the bumblebee, they will start to subside anywhere from August into October, and they do not reuse the nest. The new queens in the fall will go and fly and disperse and find some protected place to spend the winter and then start the next spring. And so it's nice if you've got a design of a house that you can clean it up and clean it out. Usually ground level would be better than things high. I have seen bumblebees nest up, you know, in a birdhouse 10 feet off the ground, but that's not the norm. They're typically searching for places that are at ground level. And so, as I said, they're out there now looking for places, so this would be the time to have them.
What kind of location would be best to put that in?
Well, you know, normally you see them like in a rock wall or, as I said, someplace else that has a cavity. Somewhat protected. You know, one of the problems that they have is that you can have skunks and other predators go after the nests and dig them up or, you know, open things up. So that's why, you know, a well-designed birdhouse probably would offer them normal protection. It really doesn't seem to matter which side, you know, compass direction they face, you know, mm-hmm. with beehives, and sometimes you're doing things for catching the sun. But with bumblebees, I just find they're looking for a void. And if they can find a void space that they feel comfortable in, they will hopefully start a nest.
Okay. Well, Mike, I hope you are able to start a bumblebee nest. Good luck, and thanks for your call. Let's go to Tim in Stanley. Hi, Tim.
Hello. Couple quick bee-related questions. Was, you know, use bee as a loose term here. A few years ago, I saw some absolutely beautiful jeweled-colored bees, which maybe were more hornets or wasps or whatever you want to call them, but they were, like, beautiful jewel-colored purple and blue and green, and I'm wondering what those are, if they're safe to be around, and if they are, if I can then do something to have more of them at my house. I know most people don't want more bees at their house. And secondary question is sweat bees, if you're familiar with those tiny little long black and yellow. Are those actually bees? Are they anything to be concerned about? What's the story with them?
Okay, we'll start with the sweat bees. There is something we officially call a sweat bee, but it's not what most the general public would call it. What I tend to find is what people call sweat bees are hoverflies, and they are black and yellow. They're a bee mimic. They can't sting because they're flies. When my daughter was growing up, that's what she used to call them and go running in the house because she was concerned about being stung, which was quite embarrassing to the dad that was the entomologist. But, you know, and the true sweat bee is kind of a very dark colored, very small critter. It potentially could sting, but it's not very aggressive. Now, indeed, to your metallic bees, there's two or three families that have a number of metallic species in that are great photographic subjects. These are all solitary bees. So again, they don't live in nests, but they live in various environments. And what we find has caused the decline of most of our native bees is habitat issues. Some of them nest in the pith of hollow plants. Some of them nest in loose soil. And so you need a diversity of habitat to have a diversity of bees. And you know, unfortunately, the classic bluegrass lawn is a desert as far as bees go. And so that's why we've seen a decline in species unless you get to a wild area that has dead trees and all kinds of things like that. So anything you do to promote diversity in your area, and, you know, the bigger area you have under your control, the better luck you're going to have, you know, because the average lawn, you're somewhat limited. But as I said, sometimes leaving dead wood on the ground and other things, or leaving bare soil areas for these creatures is a way of enhancing them. And then, of course, having flowers blooming throughout the year gives you the opportunity to draw these in from areas around you, and then you get a chance to kind of enjoy them that way. So,
okay. Well, thank you, Rusty, for the call. This is the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau, sitting in for Larry today on the Ideas Network. We've been talking with Phil Pelletieri. He's an entomologist and retired head of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. If you have a question, give us a call, 1-800-642-1234, or send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. We are talking about insects with Phil Pelletieri. And Phil, we had someone who was wondering, Susan from Stoughton, about jumping worms, that they're becoming a problem, aren't they?
Yeah, technically, entomologists don't play with jumping worms, but,
okay,
but I'm well aware of it because we're gardeners, and it's really been quite a concern. This is an Asian species of worm that has been discovered in the state now probably about 7 or 8 years, and its claim to fame is it is such an aggressive feeder on organic matter that it grossly changes the quality of the soil to the wrong degree. I mean, normally you think of worms aerating and helping. Well, this takes the organic matter out so quickly that you get kind of a hard pan. When introduced in forested situations and whatnot, it is absolutely devastating on the native plant communities because it changes things. And so, and you're finding a lot of people now that are aware, we have activity in a number of counties in the southern part of the state, particularly in the Milwaukee, Waukesha area and Madison. And then there's potential. I know of 14 counties that have positive or at least probable infestations. Probably the easiest way to spread it is on plant material, and for that reason, there's been a lot of cancellations of spring gardening sales and the like, because people are concerned that that may be a way of introducing these into new areas. And it's really a frustrating problem because there really is technically nothing you can do to kill the worms once they get introduced. And as I said, it will be very aggressive on mulch, which we often use to enhance our plants, and these will destroy the mulch so quickly, or again, leaf matter or whatever the organic matter is there. It really is not a good thing to have. And there was some hope that our winters would kill them. That unfortunately has not been the case. They overwinter as eggs. They do get quite large, upwards of, you know, 6-7 inches long. If you go on the internet, there's some guides to help you identify them. They have this white banding on their body, which helps to distinguish them from some of our native worms. But the main thing is just to be careful buying plant material. Usually out of greenhouses, that's grown in potting mixes and other things, so that shouldn't be a problem. But naturally dug plants are the ones of most concern right now.
Okay, so keep an eye out for those. And if we do find them, how do you kill them?
You don't.
You don't.
I mean, there has been some materials registered. Some of the old insecticides killed worms, but that environmentally is not a good thing. And so those chemicals are long gone. And there are some products that one place where we had some problems is in airports, where after heavy rain, the worms would crawl onto the runway, the birds would be attracted to it, and this became a safety issue. And so there were some rice extract products that have been worked with that have, in that situation, can be used, but they're not registered for home lawns or whatnot. So as I said, we're in a case that there is not a valid way of dealing with these.
Okay. Well, we'll keep in touch about that one. In the meantime, let's go back to the phones. I think our next call, let's see. We talked to Rusty already, so let's go to Phil in Wauwega. Hi, Phil.
Hello.
What's your question?
Thanks for taking my call. I am a beekeeper, and I just installed a package of bees on Saturday, and so my queen is still in her cage. I'll be taking her out this afternoon. But I have a small amount of ants around the hive, and I was wondering if there is a gentle way of taking care of these ants without harming my bees.
Okay. Do you know where the ant nest is, or are these just ants active in the area?
I do know where the nest is.
Okay.
I mean, I can see it. I tried to dig it out, and it's hard to tell if you're getting at the at the center of things.
Yeah. So what I would do, I suspect they're field ants, and these can make some very large mounds, and they can live for 10 to 12 years, and so it's kind of hard to wait them out.
Right.
And typically, what people tend to do is, if they're trying to treat it, they put some kind of chemical on the surface and try to wash it down, and it doesn't work. It really doesn't.
Okay.
Instead, though, what I think would be a solution to both solve it and also protect your bees is, what we typically tell people to do is take a metal rod or some other device that you can probe into the nest and make two or three very deep channels, as deep as you can push in. And usually that soil is pretty loose from the ants being active.
Right.
What this is allowing us to do is get deep enough to get after the queen. And then I would mix a very small amount, and it really doesn't matter what the garden insecticide is, the normal dilution rate. And what you're doing is you're drenching it down into the ground. Now, at the same time, what I think when you put the channels in, it would probably help to just rake a little bit of that soil surface away, do the drench, and when you're done, cap the top off with that untreated soil. And,
gotcha.
You know, so if I had to pick something that is short residual and is you know, very readily available, the old insecticide malathion,
okay.
You know, is probably a good one. But I wouldn't buy anything special. If you had anything around, as I said, I would go through the normal dilution rates, use it as a drench deep in the ground, and cap it with untreated soil, and I can't see that posing any threat to your bees.
Okay.
Outstanding.
All right, thank you for your call, Phil. Appreciate that. Let's go to Rusty in Marshall. Hi, Rusty.
Hi. Yeah, the other guy who signed off was Ken.
Ken, I got confused. Sorry about that. I figured it out, though.
Oh, that never happened to me.
No, never.
I have a brand-new beehive that I just assembled and put together, and it's called a horizontal top bar hive. Are you familiar with that?
Only vaguely. One of my colleagues had worked with that, but I will confess that honeybees is not my area of expertise.
Well, it resembles like a manger sitting on sawhorses, and it has a roof on it. And when you open the roof, it has flat bars, sticks that go across, and supposedly the bees are supposed to build the hive on those sticks, and I just wonder, I'm picking up my bees Saturday, and I am a complete neophyte here, and will they just go to work if I just put them in the hive?
Yeah, they should. If you can maintain them, they will start constructing. You know, we have modified the normal hives, you know, for the collection of wax and honey, you know, so that we can pull the frames and those kind of things. But when you find bees nest in tree cavities and whatnot, they will fill the space. I think you will not really have any problem. And the big question, again, because I'm not that familiar with, did they give you directions if indeed you were going to harvest any of the honey, or is your plans just to let the bees keep all their honey and go from there?
Well, I thought we were going to at least try and get some honey. You know, how much do you need? Not a whole lot.
Sure.
We're not doing this as a commercial enterprise or anything.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, if they just go to work in there, the combs will be all jackstrawed all over the place.
Yeah, see, that's why I was just, you know, picturing the difficulty of extracting the honey, and I don't know, you know, what the particulars are of the design, if they've got that problem solved, because that would be the problem.
Is there an organization that he could go
well,
to
I would
for help?
Think the manufacturer should give you quite a bit of information. Again, there has been a number of different new designs that people have looked at making life a little bit more reasonable for the bees. We lose about a third of our honeybees every year in the state, barring any other circumstances coming in. And that's always been a challenge for Wisconsin beekeepers, is to keep the colony strong enough that they can get through the winters and then go on. Because starting from scratch is both a monetary cost, and again, it slows the effectiveness of the bees versus a colony that starts right away in the spring strong and ready to go and build from there. So,
okay, well, good luck for sure, Rusty. That sounds like quite the enterprise for you. We got a great picture of a spider from Rebecca on Facebook, Phil. Can you tell her a little bit about it?
Well, I can tell from the shape it's a crab spider. I haven't particularly seen that species, but it's a really interesting one with the banded legs and the lines down the back. You know, the problem with identifying spiders is unless they have very distinctive coloration or shapes, and there's a whole lot of things that look like other spiders, you know, mimics in the thing. But to really identify them, you need a close-up of their face to look at their eye patterns. Most true spiders have 8 eyes. We have a few spiders that have 6. But, you know, which ones are big, which ones are small, and are they in 2 lines or 4 lines or whatever, are the things that entomologists and acarologists use for identification.
So if you really want to find out, you have to get eye to eye with these, or eyes to eyes.
The thing about crab spiders, they're so distinctive in their shape. Uh-huh. They generally are pretty small spiders, and at least the kinds that we have around here in Wisconsin. They are not an indoor spider in most cases, and so and there are some amazingly colorful ones. We have some that are white with pink markings, believe it or not. It doesn't look like something that should exist in Wisconsin, but some of the flower spiders are crab spiders.
Makes sense because they kind of look like the flower they're on, right? Well, she found this one on her door handle when she stopped for gas. It's like 1/4 inch. So good eyes for her for seeing it. And well, that's what you have there, Rebecca. Okay, well, let's go back to the phones. We've had Nancy on from Madison. Hi, Nancy. What do you want to talk about?
Oh.
Go ahead.
Is it me?
Yes, it's you.
Okay. So I have the occasional ugly shield bug in my house. But I've been told that as the weather warms up, I'm going to have a lot of them, and I want to know what I'm supposed to do.
Okay. Well, the good news to me is if you've not seen a lot of them by now, you're not going to. What's going on is that this Asian stink bug, this brown stink bug that has moved in the state now in the last 5 or 6 years, spends the winter in large numbers. So it migrates in the fall. On warm days, you see a couple of them, but typically in the spring when they wake up again, they should all disperse and leave. And, you know, it's still been a trickle. If you get on the internet and look like what's happened in Pennsylvania and in Maryland, it seems like a science fiction movie how bad the insects can get. We have not seen that in Wisconsin, but the uptick is instead of seeing 2 in the winter, some people are seeing 20 in the winter, and you just wonder where it's going to go. Now, the line of defense is the fall. You either have to have things sealed tight enough that they stay outside and can't find their way into your walls or attic, or if that doesn't work, then you have to probably contract for spraying services on the outside to kill them before they get in. But I don't think you're there yet. And so, as I said, I think the good news is if you're only seeing a couple, they did get in last fall, but I don't think you're going to see a big explosion this late, because it's been warm enough for the last 3 to 4 weeks that they should have been active and starting to move out. And then the question will be down the road, but you will see it coming in the fall because you'll see them clustered on the outside of the house trying to squeeze in, and then you know that you've got this potential problem. And, you know, once they get in the walls, there is no magic, you know, so that's why we really do preach that fall, either building them out or treatment is the only way to deal with them.
So they come out about the same time as the box elders?
Yeah, box elders and Asian lady beetles that whole cadre of critters that like to spend the winter rent-free. And as I said, for all of them, it's the same argument. If they're coming in the fall, you've got to stop them there. Rather than once they get in the walls, there just is no, you know, you can spray on your baseboards. That doesn't really do anything. It's a waste of time, and you're exposing yourself to insecticide when you don't need to.
So it's the outside that we have to look for. Thank you, Nancy. Julie and Mozani. Hi, what's your question? Hi.
Hi, my question is, 2 years ago, we had wasps that somehow got inside our upstairs, and it wasn't the attic, but it must have been in the walls or whatever, and they came out in our upstairs bedroom, and we were killing them. We must have had hundreds. This was 2 years ago. Now we get, in the last 2 years, we'll get an occasional wasp that comes when maybe the sun is out and there's, and we can't figure out where it's coming from, a crack inside our house. And so we kill them, and they're kind of lethargic. But are we going to have, in, are they going to be coming, are they infesting our house again? Is there anything we can put outside so we can prevent these wasps from coming into our house?
Sure. I think what you're seeing now are overwintering queens that probably have nothing to do with that original colony that gave you problems a couple years ago. But what it tells me is they're finding a way of crawling in. And if I had to start, I would check my soffit vents and my attic vents to make sure that they're screened or sealed properly, that things can't squeeze through. So again, what would happen is the wasp would crawl in the fall, stay quiet, and then when the spring starts to warm them up, and you know, it's kind of a mistake sometimes for insects to get in walls, because when they wake up, because the wall is warm, they are attracted to light. So they come down through light fixtures and all kinds of places, which is really kind of hard to know where they're coming from. But when you get this reoccurrence, it tells me that a lot of them have gotten access. And that's the way I would approach trying to prevent it, is check my vents, make things are screened, make things are caulked, if there's openings, whatever you can do to seal it for next year. Now, what happened with that original colony is a queen found some kind of void space and access. And what often happens is if they can come and go the way they normally do, they don't bother you indoors. But sometimes those openings get plugged, or people sometimes do it on purpose. And that's a big mistake, because that forces them to come in. And again, as you said, you can have hundreds of wasps showing up in a bedroom, and it's usually through a light fixture or an electrical outlet that they're finding access. But unless you solve that riddle, and the best thing to do with those, I mean, they freeze out. That's the good news. And so they will eventually take care of themselves. But as I said, with your reoccurring problem, I think it's worth spending some time and seeing what kind of things you can do to tighten up the house to prevent the potential of this problem. And again, for people who have openings in their siding, this is the time of the year to plug them before you get this whole nesting starting. Not a problem in the spring, not even a problem in the early summer. These are usually problematic in late summer and fall.
Okay. All right. Thank you for the call, Julie. Let's go to Lynn in Evansville. Hi, Lynn.
Thank you for taking my call. Phil, I have two questions about outdoor bugs. They're benign but irritating. The first is, again, a bug that's somewhere between a half and three-quarters of an inch long, rectangular and in shape as they plaster themselves against the sunny side of my house and doors. They're charcoal gray with a pink back end, and it's just that they cover them, so every time you try to go in and outside of the house, they tumble inside and you have to deal with them. I'm wondering, this is the second year I've had them, and what I might be able to do. The second has to do with us in the area mowing our lawns or working in the yard. I don't know if you call them no-see-ums, but they're very tiny little black biting bugs that usually are head, neck, ears area biting. And what can one do?
Okay. First one, I'm leaning that they're immature box elder bugs, because they look different than the adults, and they have this kind of orangish, lighter colored. But whatever it is, I would wonder if you used insecticidal soap or something similar when they're clustered. That would be very effective and a pretty benign way of taking care of them. I mean, that's whether you use regular insecticide or the soap, it's the same thing. When they're clustered, you kill them before they get a chance. The difference between the soap and the insecticides is the soap has no residual, whereas some of the insecticides, one application would last you for 2 or 3 weeks, is what I'm guessing. And is this pretty much a spring or more often a late summer and fall problem?
It went last year, the season.
Okay.
But it was more intense in the first part, the springish part. But
Do you have either a big maple or box elder tree on
the
property?
We have big maples, but no box elders in the area.
Yeah, it turns out silver maple, technically box elder is a maple. And silver maple in particular, in some years, the seeds, these are seed-feeding insects,
will
breed it. And I bet you that's the source.
Now,
you somewhat hope for a wet summer, because there is a natural fungus disease that really does a number on these things in normal years. We have the worst problem with box elders in dry years, because the fungus is not effective. So that would be the way. But as I said, when they're clustering, said the soap will work. It's just you might have to apply it two or three times to get the effect. Now, unfortunately, the critters I think that are biting you in the head are black flies. And so my first question, do you live pretty close to a river or stream?
They're not fly size. Excuse me for interrupting. You don't even barely see them. They're like dots. They're very tiny.
It turns out that the black flies are about the size of a fruit fly. Now, if they're smaller than that, there is a fly that we call a no-see-em, but it is not invisible. The difference is black flies breed in moving water, the rivers and streams and creeks, whereas no-see-ems breed in mud flats, usually on the edges of ponds and the like. No-see-ems are such weak flyers. They're kind of a dawn and dusk problem. You know, if you've got a windy day, you don't have a problem. You're sitting out at the deck as the sun goes down, and all of a sudden they come out of nowhere. But black flies are a more common problem in the state. We have a number of species. The classic black fly season is usually May and early June, although we do have species that can bother you almost any time. And what's weird is we do have occasions where they'll show up 30 miles from the breeding source. So you have this problem, and you can't let the kids out in the sandbox. One of the things that's characteristic of black fly bites is you don't feel them, but very often you get a trickle of blood associated with them, and then some people develop these nasty, nasty welts that might take 3 or 4 weeks to go away. No-see-ems, their bites typically, when people go down to Florida and they say they got bit by sand fleas, well, there is no such thing, at least in Florida, as sand fleas, and what they have are no-see-em bites. And the same type of thing is usually you have a wound, although it doesn't welt as much, doesn't bleed as much, but it itches like the dickens sometimes for 3 or 4 weeks. And so both of those are very unpleasant. But as I said, because they're breeding off your property and kind of blowing in and whatnot, there isn't a whole lot you can do other than, when things get out of hand with mosquitoes or black flies or whatnot, I go to using netting. I mean, they sell various kinds of hats or head covers that you can put over that physically will keep you protected during those bad seasons, and pray for a windy day, because as I said, that will make all the difference in the world.
Oh, they are nasty, aren't they? All right, Lynn, well, hopefully you can fight them off. Let's go to Dave in La Crosse. Hi, Dave, what's your question?
Hi, thanks. I wondered if you could suggest any place to contact. I'd like to do some useful volunteer work. I'm not trained, but I'm willing to try to learn. Work in terms of contacting or of observing or surveys of insects around southwestern Wisconsin.
Well, there's a number of organizations. There is a Wisconsin Entomological Society, which is a fun group of mostly amateur entomologists, and various people in that group have various interests. There's one person that really likes tree crickets and does all kinds of neat work and survey work, and so I think you can find people who have some interest there. There's also a group called the Prairie Enthusiasts, and I know some of the people active with that. There are some very interesting and unique insects on prairies, and in particular, there's a lot of neat stuff in the southwest part of the state that we don't see elsewhere, just in that driftless area and whatnot, because it's such a unique area. So those are two areas in particular that come to mind, organizations that, again, I think you can find some people there that will have some ongoing types of things. Butterfly groups, too. I mean, within Wisconsin Entomological Society, there are people that love butterflies and making observations of what's flying, where you're finding them, those kinds of things. There is a lovely site called Wisconsin Butterflies. It's not associated with the Entomological Society. And there people often post their sightings within individual counties and whatnot. So you get to see when the first cabbage whites were flying, and it's interesting. Over time, people make some great observations and see things that are not normal. And of course, being able to share that is always very fun. So.
Okay, well, that sounds like fun, Dave. I hope you find someone you can volunteer for. You've been listening to The Larry Mueller Show. I am Jill Nadeau, sitting in for Larry today on the Ideas Network. We're talking with Phil Pelletieri. He's an entomologist and retired head of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. Do you have a question for him? You can give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. The lines have been pretty busy, but we actually have one open right now. And, of course, you can always send an email, and that address is ideas@wpr.org. Hi, this is Jill Nadeau in for Larry Mueller today, and we're talking about bugs. And talking about bugs, Larry has the flu bug. I don't know if you can help him at all, Phil.
No, that's one, unfortunately.
That's one you're not good with, huh? All right. Well, let's go back to the phones and talk to Ron in Madison. Hi, Ron. What's your question?
Thanks, Dr. Phil and Jill. Two beetles, one bumblebee concern me. First, tiny black beetles about an eighth of an inch long and narrower, about the size of pencil lead. I collected over 100 out of one little office. Second is a two-tone beetle, maybe 3/8 of an inch long, probably 3/16 of an inch wide. The front third and the back third are almost black, but the middle third is medium to light gray. I've only collected three of those. And the rusty patch bumblebee is finally on the endangered species list. Sunday, we drove through the point of one of its tiny habitat areas east of Belleville, and I noticed that most of the soils that I could see were underwater after the rain. So one of the questions is, do the queens of that species need overwintering sites that have well-drained soil so they don't drown while they're hibernating? Also, Monday, I planted a patch, two patches of shady mix wildflower seeds. Besides planting flowers, not just wild ones, but domesticated ones too, to provide nectar and pollen for this endangered species, what else can we do for them? I looked on the federal website. There are scattered tiny patches of habitat in 13 states and in Ontario, but there are only two big clusters. One is in the Twin Cities and the suburbs in Minnesota. The other's in Dane County, specifically roughly the western half of Madison plus adjoining areas. So lots of topics. Any idea what two beetles might be and how can we help that bumblebee survive?
Sure. The bigger critter, I suspect, is a larder beetle. And larder beetles feed on high-protein food. And so the typical scenario is you have something as innocent as a mouse that dies in your wall. These things find it, they breed on it, and then when the adults come out, they show their presence. We see them breed in high-protein dog food and other things. I'm not really concerned about that. If it was a big food source, I think your nose would tell you something was amiss. And the way to deal with the big food source is remove it. And so, as I said, it probably was as innocent as that. Now, the little critters, I'm leaning to something like a sawtooth grain beetle or a flower beetle, something that you would be associating with dry goods. That includes spices and potpourri, anything that's plant material will breed some of these grain insects. And so you get these explosions, but what it comes to is trying to hunt down what that food source could be. And usually if you remove the food source and then you make sure that other things that they could potentially get in are sealed in containers that they don't have access to, you solve it. So it's a sanitation issue for really both of these problems rather than something we would spray for. And I said, hopefully this will give you some direction of what kind of things to poke around and look for. And it might be as innocent as I always tell people, if you see the critters in your kitchen, of course, everybody's got a cupboard full of stuff, but if you find them in the bedroom, that's an odd place. And so, it could be a Christmas wreath made out of walnuts that's up in a closet somewhere. And so you kind of have to put that kind of mindset of being a detective and chasing it down. Now, the problem with the rusty patch bumblebee, there's pesticides and other things that are not helpful. But to be honest, I think, from what I'm aware of, the problem with some species of bumblebees thriving and other ones being really suffering major population losses in the last 15 years in particular, some of this is habitat reduction, but a lot of it, we think, is disease issues, that some diseases have been introduced that these particular species are very prone to getting. Now, the overwintering sites, bumblebees, I think, normally are smart enough to get a little bit high and dry. and the like. What we do find is a problem at times for some of these ground nesting bees in the spring are heavy rains, because it can flood the nests out. So there's unfortunately not a lot we can do for that. But you know, what you're doing at least to provide a food source is a start. And again, if you're talking a broader picture, is providing habitat, which is going to basically be fence rows that are not sprayed with herbicide and other things. I mean, we need some wild places for these things to be able to thrive. And as I said, that's often why it's problematic. Although, you know, it's interesting, as you mentioned, that you can have an urban Western Dane County and still have some bumblebees, but there are these fragments of wild areas that are helping support these critters. And a neat critter if you can see it. Unfortunately, it has become really quite rare, whereas, you know, 30 years ago, one would have a whole different picture of. We have about 9-10 species of bumblebees in the state, and we've been having species that have been threatened. You know, we had a prairie dominant species that, you know, in the last 60 years, of course, has suffered immensely. And some of our bumblebees here are not native, which is, I think, maybe interesting to some people. So,
okay. Well, Ron, thank you for your concern on that. Let's go to Mary in Stevens Point. Hi, Mary. I think we might have addressed this a little bit, but what's your question?
Yes, I'd like to build on the information that Phil Pelletier Thierry has already given us regarding box elder bugs. I have a large infestation in the garage, and it's migrating toward the house. I've been using a solution of soapy water in a shop vac, and that kills any that I can catch. But I think I'm missing millions of them, and I don't want to use insecticides, so I'm wondering what more I could do to discourage the population that's building in the area of the garage. I took out some rhubarb and removed the compost pile because I saw there were great numbers clustered there. Anything else any suggestions?
Boy, I think you'll find that putting an effort to controlling them in the fall is more effective than in the spring, because now you're just getting critters waking up and moving out. And, you know, the one thing I can assure you is they're not breeding in the garage, and everything you see now basically came into the property last fall. Now, where it gets ticklish is, you know, on a larger scale, some communities have banned box elder as a curb tree because of this occasional problem with box elders. If you're lucky enough to only have one or two trees in the area and those trees are removed, you've solved the problem. But even if you've got trees in your yard, I will tell you, I've seen box elder bugs move from 250 yards away. And you know, if your neighbor has a tree and they like the tree, they're probably not going to be happy. And as we were talking earlier, on occasion where the numbers are high, we see them breeding on silver maple also. And silver maple, I think, normally is considered a more acceptable yard tree for most people. But it goes back to the point that these are seed-feeding insects, and if there are no seeds for them to feed on, they don't breed. And so that's where the direction of tree removal at times turns out to be a potential solution. But unfortunately, other than the soaps, and you know, one of my favorite stories about the soap. Some people know I've been trying to write a book, and this story comes back to the original Larry Mueller, right? In what we used to suggest to people, because a colleague down in Iowa State said, you know, a half a cup of Tide laundry detergent to a gallon of water is just great. So we'd often suggest that, and a caller called in and said, you know, I tried Cheer and it didn't work.
Oh.
Well, it turns out soap chemistries differ. In fact, even one batch to Tide. And so that's why you notice I recommended insecticidal soap, because it is the right 18-carbon-long fatty acid soap with no whiteners, brighteners, or other things that can cause problems on your plants. So
there's
a reason we talk about the insecticidal soap as being, I know what's in there, I know it will work, I know it's the right dilutions, and I know it won't hurt plants if you follow their directions. But as we mentioned, the limitation of these things is that it only kills what it contacts. And the only thing I know that can kill an insect past that point is going to some of the more traditional insecticides, where the residual, that if the critter walks on the surface any time in the next 2 or 3 weeks, it potentially will die.
Okay. Well, I think we're all kind of in the same boat there, Mary. If you come up with anything, let us know. We've got a couple of minutes left. Phil, let's. Carol emailed, and she wanted to know if you can identify a very thin centipede-like creature that she found in her basement. It's light beige in color and a couple of inches long with short legs. She says it's not a millipede because the body isn't crunchy. What could that
be? Well, it could be a centipede. I mean, we have native ones, and we have a kind of a domestic one that you only find indoors. The thing about centipedes is they're usually quite quick. They have one pair of legs for every body segment, and they tend to be somewhat flattened creatures, whereas millipedes tend to be more cylindrical, and if you look close enough, they have two pairs of legs for every one of their bodies, and they tend to be very slow. Centipedes are predators. Millipedes are plant feeders, and so... If it's problematic, one of the things to do is get these mouse glue boards that you put out, and if these crawl on it, they get caught on it, so it's kind of a physical way of reducing the populations.
Okay, and they tend to like all the damp places.
Prefer damp areas, although, you know, one of the things you tell people, you can never get rid of all of them because there are ones that can live in the walls and elsewhere, and you just don't have access to that. Clutter is also an issue. You know, if you had nothing in your basement, no place to hide, but of course, all of us have all kinds of good things in our basement.
Oh, I don't. So, yeah. Right, because that's what you're going to move something and you're going to see them. So,
yes.
Okay. All righty. Well, we have been talking with Phil Pelletieri. He's an entomologist and a distinguished faculty associate emeritus. He retired as head of the UW-Madison Diagnostic Lab in 2014, and he joins us every other month to share his knowledge with us. We're going to be back right after the news, so please stay with us on the Ideas Network, and we'll take more of your calls. Well, we are talking about insects today. Hi, Jill Nadeau here. I'm in for Larry Mueller today. Glad to have you with us on the Ideas Network. Phil Pelletieri is back with us. He's an entomologist and a distinguished faculty associate emeritus. Phil retired as head of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab a few years back, and he comes by regularly to talk about insects. Have you been having an insect problem? Have you seen a bug you can't identify? Well, give us a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Or you could always post on the Larry Mueller Facebook page. We'd love to see those photos if you have them. So, Phil, do you like our new music?
I do.
Maybe you told me that you are playing guitar, so maybe you can come up with one that we can play when you're on.
Yes, but I'm more into blues, which doesn't give you quite the same feel as the bluegrassy.
It's not as up, but you could be blue about your bug problem, or you could be blue about ticks. Now, we had Daniel on Facebook who asked if you can elaborate on the life cycle of ticks and, you know, the ones that spread Lyme disease and how rodent populations affect that.
Sure. So what we typically refer to as the deer tick, or some people call the bear tick, is an animal that is officially called the black-legged tick. And it has a two-year life cycle from the time the eggs are laid until the adults feed. They only mate once. The female lays eggs, and that is, she lays a couple thousand eggs, and that kills her. It's that exhausting. So the interesting thing about this deer tick is it's capable of transmitting a number of diseases. Lyme disease, anaplasmosis, ehrlichiosis, babesiosis are four. And honestly, every 4 or 5 years, we seem to discover a new disease. And every one of them that I mentioned are rodent diseases. And what the tick is a bridge that it picks it up from the rodent and then transmits to the next animal. And if that animal's susceptible, and unfortunately, humans are susceptible to all four of those. So the white-footed mouse is often was the first rodent, I think, that was implicated as being a reservoir, and the tick feeds on those. But it turns out that other rodents, in particular chipmunks, also play a part into this. And so every time we find the new disease, it's that same story. It was something that was occurring in rodents, and the tick has the capacity to transmit it. And what's critical here is when they feed, they acquire it they go through their molting and maturing process, and they still are capable of transmitting the disease. Our old-fashioned, what we call a wood tick, which is the American dog tick, is not capable of transmitting. So it's unique to this deer tick, black-legged tick group, that they are the vectors. And so there is this relationship, and you know, as we're studying the ecology of this, there's an interesting relationship that they found out east that the year after a heavy acorn year increased the number of Lyme disease cases, and they correlated that with the increased rodent populations because there was more nuts to feed on. If there's more rodents, there's more potential. And so, as I said, these interactions between various things in nature are really quite interesting. But it does come down to a rodent disease and a capable tick vector, and that's what we have been putting up with. And, you know, I was always so fascinated because this is one of these things that unfolded in my career of where this tick came from. And you know, during the Ice Age, we had no ticks here.
It was cold, though, yes. So, you know, you have your pluses and minuses.
It got reintroduced, and our first records go back to 1969 when one of the graduate students found a tick on a mouse up in the Spooner area, and it turned out to be this black-legged tick, which is primarily a southern tick. And now with the help of DNA and whatnot, we can find that this basically was a reintroduction from probably Texas. In that area. And sure, the tick got up here a number of times, but one of the critical factors they need was a certain deer density to be able to support the tick population. Mm-hmm. So there's always these very interesting interactions, and we can pretty much track the movement of Lyme disease and the tick out of that northwest part of the state and moving. And it took, you know, we didn't have records in all the counties here until about 7 or 8 years ago. And then, of course, the relationship. When the tick gets there, then people start getting sick. And without the tick, we don't have Lyme disease. Now, in the United States, there are other diseases transmitted by other ticks that sometimes confuses things. And as I said, I'm not sure that we have. In fact, I am totally sure we do not have all these things worked out yet. There are probably other yet undescribed things. But it's so interesting how they always seem to point back to the rodent populations.
Okay. Well, thank you for that. And thank you for the question, Daniel. Let's go back to the phones. And we've had Lucille. Oh, and looks like she's got some solutions about getting rid of another pest. Hi, Lucille.
Hi.
What was your solution?
Well, it happened kind of accidentally. I needed some mulch for my plants and yada yada, and I got it from the county, and it was a combination of different kinds of cedar and whatever. But it boiled down to what I found out. If I take the pet, you know, stuff that you put in your pets.
Are you talking about like shaved cedar for beds?
Yeah, a bedding. Pet
okay.
Bedding.
Mm-hmm.
And if you make sure there's cedar in there or some kind of pine, I've been spreading. Well, anyways, I got this stuff from the county. I spread it around the house. My garage door was brown with box elder bugs. When I got this stuff from the county with all that stuff in it, the bugs are gone within a day. So then I decided to figure out what, and it turned out to be the cedar or the pine. Okay, now that gets rid of the box elder bugs to a point. Now, what I want to know and what I want to ask you is, there is a thing that people are saying with peppermint gets rid of bugs and all that kind of stuff, and it does work. I'm mm-hmm. not going to say it's done because I've sprayed it around my windowsills and I don't get all these bugs in. But will that hurt other things like bees and...
Sure.
Have you heard anything about that?
Well, in the last 15 years, there's been a number of chemicals that were already registered as food additives that are natural oils that have now been registered for use as insecticides. And cedar oil is one of them, and peppermint oil is another. And they do have toxic effects on contact on insects. So if you sprayed a bee you could probably kill it. There's pennyroyal oil, as I said, there's a number of these things that are out there. But one of the things that happens, let's say if you spray your windowsill, in particular things like ants, it's not that they're killed, they're repelled by it. I mean, ants are so chemically sensitive that when something strange is in front of them, they will not cross that barrier. And so you're getting that benefit. It's not, working as an insecticide, but it's working as a repellent. So I think you've got a couple things that can be going on here. And as I said, the natural oils, you can buy products that are made with just these various oils and combinations. I will say that sometimes things have been overstated. In fact, somebody had been using cedar oil for bedbug control and making incredible claims about it. And eventually the federal government stepped in and said, you got to stop because there's no science to back this up. So it was a partial truth is probably a way of putting it. Because the same thing is if a bedbug was in front of you and you sprayed it with cedar oil, you would kill it. But it had no residual. And that's the one thing that the oils are showing us for the most part is the residual is relatively short, much like the soaps we talked about. So they do have their potential uses. I'm not sure if your observation of box elder bugs was a repellency going on. I would think it's more that than it killed them, that they just didn't like it. I've never tried that experiment, but it wouldn't surprise me.
Well, and it wouldn't be expensive to try, so it might be worth trying, at least in the fall, maybe, yes, to keep them away from the house. So, well, thank you, Lucille. I really appreciate that. And if anybody else tries it and it works, please let us know. Let's go to Joel in Milwaukee. Hi, Joel. What's your question?
For several months, like most of this winter, I've seen in my apartment a tiny dark brown bug, approximately a tenth of an inch, so it's very tiny, and I see it usually crawling, sometimes flying on my dining table or the walls, sometimes on the carpet. And now I live in a large apartment building, so maybe the bug comes from one of the other apartments. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. For this, because I can think of a couple, three possibilities. There's some gnats that breed in houseplant soil. Because your observation of getting them flying, I can rule out a number of the insects that come in, pet food and those kind of things. But I think a way of getting an answer is if you can get a couple of them and send a sample in, and PJ Leash is running the diagnostic lab now. And so you can take it either to the Milwaukee Extension office and see if they can identify it. If not, they'll send it in, or you can send it directly into PJ. The address at the lab is 1630 Linden Drive, Madison. The zip is 53706. For something bigger, I'd say even try to take a picture, but my fear is that this is small enough, the picture will not give enough detail that PJ can identify it. But I think if we know what it is, at least we can point you in a direction of where the source would be. And, being active in the winter, it's got to be something coming from indoors that they're breeding on. And that's why, I was thinking either food products or plant material are the two most likely sources.
Okay. Well, thanks for the call, Joel. That insect diagnostic lab is very helpful in those circumstances. Let's go to Rob in Milwaukee. Hi, Rob.
Hi, Phil. Hi, Joe.
Hi.
I'm in southeastern Wisconsin, and what is the first butterfly we could expect to see this time of year? Because I've seen some activity.
Sure. I've seen three things. The first thing was that little cabbage white butterfly, which overwinters in the pupal stage. But I've also seen some red admirals, and I've seen some painted ladies. And both of those are migratory butterflies that can blow in here. Now, a couple other ones you might run into, the morning cloak butterfly overwinters as an adult. And even in March, on a sunny day, you can see those become active. And a couple of the question marks and other nymphalid butterflies also overwinter as adults. So any of those are possible. But the first one I saw definitely was the cabbage white. And I'm going back probably 3 weeks now, at least two, that I saw my first one on every sunny day, which amazes me because there isn't a whole lot of plants up yet for them to lay their eggs on, at least not my broccoli plants yet. But They're always out there, so it's kind of fun. You know, the migratory ones, you get some years you don't see them. Some years you get unbelievable numbers of them. It's a little early to call yet, but we haven't had enough strong southern weather patterns. But, you know, there's years in my career that I remember seeing these incredible migrations of painted ladies from New Mexico making it to Wisconsin. And the way I define it being really very active is when somebody would call me from the golf course because there was these clouds of butterflies going past them as they were golfing. It got their attention that much. That tells you how impressive it can be under the right circumstances.
Oh, that's amazing. Now, do we have to worry about getting colder weather for these butterflies? Or
no, anything here, basically, they kind of go on hold or suspended animation if things get real cold.
Okay.
And most of our native butterflies are going to be active later. I mean, if you think about it, you're foolish to come out before the plants that you're going to raise your young are going to be out there. Even if we got the kind of temperatures that would cause plant injury, my insects are going to survive that. So, mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, great. Thanks for that awesome question, Rob. Let's go to Craig in Delavan. Hi, Craig.
Hi.
Sounds like you got a problem.
Huh?
It sounds like you have a problem.
Yes, with the, they're kind of, I don't know if they're a millipede, centipede, they're about an inch and a quarter long.
Mm-hmm.
And they, come into my garage. I got a two-car garage. I live on Rock River in Janesville, and man, these things just are horrible. Every day, I can sweep my garage out,
mm-hmm.
and I'll have at least a cup of these things. And they climb up on the sides of the house. They're in the yard. I can see them in the grass. Mm-hmm. I had a new driveway put in, and they it's 260 feet long, and they took all that out. All the old blacktop, and then they put down new stone, and I could see hundreds and hundreds of these things all over the place, you know.
Sure.
And they covered them with blacktop, and for a little while that kind of stopped it because, you know, it was heat and it probably killed a bunch of them, but now they're back in full force, you know. You just sweep them up. I'm not sure what they are or how to get rid of them.
Yeah, so they are millipedes, and what these things do is they crawl around at night, and then when the sun comes up, they would try to accumulate where it's cool, damp, and dark. And so that's the explanation of getting on your garage floor. I can assure you they're not breeding there because by nature, these things live in the ground, and they feed on rich organic matter. So a gravel driveway is not the place that they would do, but it isn't a place they will accumulate. So here comes the bad news. They are typically migrating in from an area away from you. Often we find it's next to prairies or other areas that have lots of organic matter. And I remember my colleague Stan Temple, Stan, I think this comes on the show, talks about birds.
Yes.
Was telling me he was tracking one of these in his backyard, and he figured it could move 100 yards in approximately 10 minutes. And so what we're finding is when people have the experience that you do, is the potential source can be a long distance away. And you know, so people are inclined to say, give me something to spray on my garage floor or whatnot. And that's not going to get you anywhere because that's not the source of it. I don't believe it's your lawn. There's not enough organic matter there. The question is the property around you? You know, do you have marshes or other areas that might have the right conditions to breed these? Now, in most cases, when you get this science fiction type numbers that you see, it's been a population explosion. And what you tend to see is over time that it will go away. And it may reoccur a couple, 3 years from now. But I think everything that you're experiencing now goes back to last fall. That's when they were migrating in. The ones that survived and, you know, spent the winter in your rocks and whatnot are now waking up. And that's why you're seeing them. Pray for somewhat dry weather. That will tend to slow them up. And again, I'm afraid to say that in the long run, the only thing that changes that is land use change. You know, when the ground that they're coming from changes, then you don't see them anymore. But, you know, I've seen them coming out of old cornfields, you know, again, hay pastures, other things. But it's always areas that if you get in the soil, it's pretty rich with organic matter, and that's what's breeding them.
Okay, makes sense. Let's go to Joel in Madison. Hi, Joel.
Oh, yes, hi. Good morning. See, about a year ago, you were talking about bee boards. Boards that you construct by just drilling holes in them to attract wild bees.
Mm-hmm.
And what type of wood would one use to do this? I went online to look for it, and I couldn't find any information.
Oh, I think a lot of times they use wood that tends to hold up from weathering, and so a lot of times it's cedar in other, you know, woods of that type. You can use anything. I mean, I've even seen people take pieces of oak log and just drill the holes in the side of the log and provide that. I'm a little surprised you didn't find anything on, you know, because in Europe in particular, this has become extremely popular, and you see these incredible bee hotels is the only way I can describe it, where they're very artistically put together with various different dimension holes and different substrates, and they build it up to look like a big castle or, you know, something similar. And again, all it basically is various pieces of wood drilled with different size holes and then put together kind of in a geometric mosaic, so it has a nice visual effect. So, but you don't have to get fancy like that. As I said, you can take an old log, you know, 6 to 8 inches in diameter, and just drill the ends with holes and put it out there, and that will provide the environment that the bees are looking for.
So the bees will just find it on their own? You don't have to track them?
You know, in a natural setting, they honestly are using the old wood borer beetle holes in dead trees.
Oh, okay.
You know, so that goes back to what we discussed about, you know, diversity of landscape. And those kinds of things you first wouldn't think about is important for certain bee species, but that's the make or break for them in being able to breed or not.
Okay, that's wonderful. Let's go, hopefully, Jill, that you'll have good luck attracting those bees. And let's go to Joanne in Crystal Lake. Hi, Joanne.
Hi, thanks for taking my call, and thank you for the program. It's excellent. Our problem is wasps, and we had them bad last year, and they seem to get into the house. I see them either dead or half-dead by the screen, you know, I'll let one out if, you know, if they're just, that's the easiest way to get rid of them, and then I'll see two more, you know, or... And it just, I don't know what it is about last year and this year that's causing that. We have a cedar roof, and I you know, they seem to go by that a lot. And I don't know if the resin attracts them, and then we just stick around.
I mean, one of the things that has changed in the last 4 or 5 years for us in southern Wisconsin is there's a new species of European paper wasp that has moved in. And it likes to make its nests underneath things. So shutters and potentially the cedar roofing material. And, you know, they start like all these from the queen in the spring and builds the colonies. But the colonies don't get very big. We're talking 40 or 50 individuals, not 2,000. But you can have multiple colonies. And so, again, everything you're seeing now has to be queens. And if there's that many queens around the house, there's that much habitat. And it goes back to what you can do to adjust. Now, you know, as I had talked about earlier, if, you know, if it's access to the attic where a bunch of things are getting the attic and making their nests, that can be dealt with. But if it's, you know, shake cedar shingles, then it gets a little bit more difficult because you're not going to rip the roof off just not to get wasps. I think in extreme cases, you know, if it really becomes problematic, it may be something that you would consider having somebody come in and spray the roof for you in the spring. I mean, this is the time to do it, you know, next month or so. But as I said, that's an extreme way of dealing with it. In the short run, I would look more to see whatever you could do to cut access off. As I said, definitely check if you've got any kind of attic space or soffits to poke around there to see if there's some weakness there.
Okay. Is there a cutoff date when they really... shouldn't be trying to keep them out?
No, but the earlier you do it, that's the best time to put the fire out.
Okay, great. Well, thanks again, Phil. Always wonderful to have you on. So much information for us. We've been talking with Phil Pelletieri. He is an entomologist and a distinguished faculty associate emeritus. Phil retired as head of UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab in 2014. Thanks to Lexi Broad for on-air production and to Dave Potras for technical direction. Join us tomorrow at 11. Jim Ward will be back with us to talk cars. I'm Jill Nadeau, sitting in for Larry Mueller. Thanks for being with us.